The Wrong Box by Robert Louis Stevenson and Lloyd Osborne. Recording by John Rowland. Chapter 1. In which Morris suspects. How very little does the amateur, dwelling at home at ease, comprehend the labours and perils of the author, and when he smilingly skims the surface of a work of fiction, how little does he consider the hours of toil, consultation of authorities, researches in the Bodleian, correspondence with learned and illegible Germans, in one word, the vast scaffolding that was first built up and then knocked down to while away an hour for him in a railway train. Thus I might begin this tale with a biography of Tonti, birthplace, parentage, genius, probably inherited from his mother, remarkable instance of precocity, etc., and a complete treatise on the system to which he bequeathed his name. The material is all beside me in a pigeonhole, but I scorn to appear vainglorious. Tonti is dead, and I never saw anyone who even pretended to regret him. And as for the Tontine system, a word will suffice for all the purposes of this unvarnished narrative. A number of sprightly youths, the more the merrier, put up a certain sum of money, which is then funded in a pool under trustees. Coming on for a century later, the proceeds are fluttered for a moment in the face of the last survivor, who is probably deaf, so that he cannot even hear of his success, and who is certainly dying, so that he might just as well have lost. The peculiar poetry and even humour of the scheme is now apparent, since it is one by which nobody concerned can possibly profit. But its fine, sportsmanlike character endeared it to our grandparents. When Joseph Finsbury and his brother Masterman were little lads in white-frilled trousers, their father, a well-to-do merchant in Cheapside, caused them to join a small but rich tontine of 37 lives. £1,000 was the entrance fee, and Joseph Finsbury can remember to this day the visit to the lawyers, where the members of the tontine, all children like himself, were assembled together, and sat in turn in the big office chair and signed their names, with the assistance of a kind old gentleman in spectacles and Wellington boots. He remembers playing with the children afterwards on the lawn at the back of the lawyer's house, and a battle royal that he had with a brother tontiner who had kicked his shins. The sound of war called forth the lawyer from where he was dispensing cake and wine to the assembled parents in the office, and the combatants were separated, and Joseph's spirit, for he was the smaller of the two, commended by the gentleman in the Wellington boots, who vowed that he had been just such another at the same age. Joseph wondered to himself if he had worn at that time little Wellingtons and a little bald head, and when, in bed at night, he grew tired of telling himself stories of sea-fights, he used to dress himself up as the old gentleman and entertain other little boys and girls with cake and wine. In the year 1840 the 37 were all alive. In 1850 their numbers had decreased by 6. In 1856 and 1857 business was more lively, for the Crimea and the Mutiny carried off no less than 9. There remained in 1870 but 5 of the original members, and at the date of my story, including the 2 Finsburys, but 3. By this time Masterman was in his 73rd year. He had long complained of the effects of age, having long since retired from business, and now lived in absolute seclusion under the roof of his son Michael, the well-known solicitor. Joseph, on the other hand, was still up and about, and still presented but a semi-venerable figure on the streets in which he loved to wander. This was the more to be deplored, because Masterman had led, even to the least particular, a model British life: industry, regularity, respectability, and a preference for the 4% are understood to be the very foundations of a green old age. All these Masterman had eminently displayed, and here he was, abogendo, at 73, while Joseph, barely 2 years younger, and in the most excellent preservation, had disgraced himself through life by idleness and eccentricity. Embarked in the leather trade, he had early wearied of business, for which he was supposed to have small parts. A taste for general information, not properly checked, had soon begun to sap his manhood. There is no passion more debilitating to the mind, unless perhaps it be that itch of public speaking which it not infrequently accompanies or begets. The two were conjoined in the case of Joseph. The acute stage of this double malady, that in which the patient delivers gratuitous lectures, soon declared itself with severity, and not many years had passed over his head before he would have